All right. Hello, everyone. It's good to see you. Lisa and I kind of rushed in the house about half an hour ago. We this morning at 4:30 and went up to La Vida and met some new friends there and watched the sunrise. It was pretty spectacular.
The eclipse.
And we saw the eclipse on the way down from the car. Yeah, we saw the eclipse in the car as we were driving. And then we had breakfast and came back. So, oh, Mike is going in and out. There's nothing I can do about that. It's okay now. All right, I am plugged in. So, and I did get kicked out of Pal Talk a moment ago. So if the internet here ends up being bad, so that you guys can't hear me, then I can. Okay. And I can just leave and go do something else. All right, we're good now. Anyway, if you want to see our pictures from the sunrise this morning down in La Vida, go have a look at my Facebook page. I posted them and it was really incredible. So go have a peek. And I am going to get us started with a song. I've picked out a song from, he's an Ama devotee. His name is Amitabhan. And the name of the song is Home. Thank you. right. And I see Cheryl says, nice pics. She went and looked at the pics of the sunrise in Lavida. And yeah, it was gorgeous. When we first got there, the sun was just beginning to come up. It was more like there was a glow in the east. The peaks were like two shadows, but you were just starting to be able to see them. And then the moon was up and turning kind of orange right next to this other mountain called Baldy. And it was just like no matter where you looked, it was like this feast for the eyes that would not quit. It was really a gorgeous morning. So, and we've been invited back tomorrow for a sunrise walk. So we're actually going to get up in the morning at 4:30 and to La Vida again. So we're becoming locals, right, Lisa?
Indeed,
Indeed.
we own the place.
We All right. So I am beginning today. I'm here the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, for anyone who doesn't know that. And I'm beginning today on page 28 of the book, question number 23. And Anne, yeah, you'll have to go look at those pictures if you haven't yet. You'll love them. They're similar to the pictures that I take off my back porch because it's really the same view. It's just I'm, 75 miles closer. So it's a close-up view of the peaks instead of a faraway view of the peaks, but it's nice. They're nice pictures. All right, here's the question, number 23. It is an established rule, and this is the questioner, by the way. It is an established rule that so long as there is the least idea of I am the doer, self-knowledge cannot be attained. But is it possible for an aspirant who is a householder to discharge his duties properly without this sense? So again, this is probably a man with a wife and children and some kind of a job he has to go to every day. And he's wondering, can I reach self-realization? Can I experience the fact that I am not when I have all of these responsibilities? It's a question that maybe many of you can identify with. Again, the question is, it is an established rule that so long as there is the least idea of I am the doer, self-knowledge cannot be attained. But is it possible for an aspirant who is a householder to discharge his duties properly without this sense? Okay, here comes Ramana Maharshi's answer. As there is no rule that action should depend upon a sense of being the doer, it is unnecessary to doubt whether any action will take place without a doer or an act of doing. Although the officer of a government treasury may appear, in the eyes of others, doing his duty attentively and responsibly all day long, he will be discharging his duties without attachment, thinking, I have no real connection with all this money, and without a sense of involvement in his mind. In the same manner, a wise householder may also discharge without attachment the various household duties which fall to his lot according to his past karma, like a tool in the hands of another. Action and knowledge are not obstacles to each other. And I have that last sentence underlined and starred. Action and knowledge are not obstacles to each other. And to me, this is what the Bhagavad Gita is all about, which is why I personally love the Bhagavad Gita. To me, the story of the Bhagavad Gita is all about just living whatever life the universe is giving you, living it, responsibly and effectively, but not having any attachment to it at the exact same time. And of course, interestingly, if you haven't read the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, who is the devotee in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is his lord. Arjuna is a general in an army, and his responsibility is to fight a war. And even to thicken the plot a little more, the opposite side are his relatives. It's really a split kingdom, and they're fighting each other, but they're family. And what happens near the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna just says, "I can't do this. I mean, those are my cousins, that's my uncle. You know, I can't fight this war." And Krishna gives him guidance that this is his responsibility, this is his action, his karma. This is his karma, and that he needs to go ahead and fight. However, he can fight without any attachment. He can fight without any desire to actually win, although in the end I think they did win. But you know, he can just do what comes to him to do, even when it's fight a war and kill your relatives. So it's a pretty extreme teaching. You can do what comes to you to do without any attachment, without seeing yourself as the person, without seeing yourself as the doer. This past Sunday, I was asked to come and be the guest minister at a physical church here in Pueblo, and I've been there before. They told me I've been there 3 times before. And they also reminded me I did a 2-day retreat for them. I had forgotten. So when I went, I knew I was going to do a talk similar to the talk I did here the previous Sunday, which was about relationships. But I also knew it would be different. You know, just kind of relationships was the basic topic. And about 20 minutes before the house to go, I sat down and I jotted down 3 scriptures word for word, you know, because sometimes I have trouble remembering things. So I jotted them down and a couple quotes from Bernadette Roberts' book, and I left. And I really had no idea what I was going to say, which probably doesn't surprise you guys at all. I had no idea how this was going to all come together, but I went with my quotes with an idea that I was talking about relationships, and that was it. And when I stood up and I began speaking, and I can't repeat it for you guys, I wish I could, but this incredible sermon, just incredible sermon came out of me. And I was even hearing it myself going, wow. It was really good. It truly was. And so when it ended, everybody was coming up to me and, you know, and telling me what a great sermon it was and what a great speaker I was. And I genuinely felt like I could not take any credit, because I knew, and you guys know, that the amount of planning I did was minimal. I wrote a few scriptures, a couple of quotes, I had an idea I was going to talk about relationships, and then the rest of it happened. And if I was to take credit for that, there's a dishonesty in that. It's a dishonesty that most people don't actually recognize, no fault of their own, right? You know, most people think that if it came out of this voice, came through these hands, right? Then I must have done it. But that's just not true. And that's what this idea, I am not the doer, really means. Something else is moving through us. We may think that it's us, but that's called thinking. That's not truth. And so, since the truth is the movement's going to happen through you, all you have to do is put yourself there, agree to go. Like when they asked me to come and be the minister, I had to say yes. And they wanted a topic in advance, so I did have to know it was going to be about relationships and make up a title so they could put a program. But it would be genuinely dishonest of me to say, oh yeah, I'm brilliant. I mean, the talk was brilliant. You know, like I said, I heard it too. The talk was brilliant. But for me to say, I'm brilliant, you know, I gave that brilliant talk, I'm a great speaker, that's a false claim. And so what I tried to say to a few of them, although I noticed I had to let go of that too, I tried to say, you know, that it, you know, it wasn't me. All I had was this piece of paper, and the rest of that just happened. But I could tell that I needed to drop that too, because because it was what it was. They saw it as me, and I just needed to humbly say thank you and let it be. Yeah, it wasn't going to fly. Exactly. It was a waste of time trying to tell him it wasn't me. So that's the point of view that Ramana and Krishna are saying that we can have about all things. Certainly, we are witnessing what this body appears to do, and we are witnessing what this voice appears to say. And we're a very, very close witness. I don't experience anything. I experience Lisa like I experience Regina, right? This is a, I always say it's like we're in a 4D movie. And we each have a seat that's kind of like a robot seat. It's a body, and we wrap around us, and that's our seat in this 4D movie. And the reason I say it's 4D is because we see out to the 3D world, but then we also have the inner dimension where we know all of the feelings that are coming with this character, all of the thoughts that are coming with this character. So that's what I call the fourth dimension in this movie. It's a 4D movie, and we each have a seat. And it's a wonder, every one of us has a great seat. And we move around within this 4D movie and these seats, and we experience it from our seat. But we're experiencing a movie from a seat, right? That's different than I am doing this. It's a completely different perspective. We're experiencing a movie from a seat. I experience from the Regina seat, Lisa experiences from the Lisa seat. Kathy from the Kathy seat, Cheryl from the Cheryl seat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the movie is just running. And then the mind claims what this body does, what this seat does, and says, I did it. But even if the mind didn't claim it and say, I did it, it would still be done. It would still happen. So if we can have that attitude that I'm just in a seat here, in a 4D movie, and I'm watching, then the body is just as much a part of the movie as everything else. And we get to see, we each have an intimate sight into one character in the movie because that character is our seat. We can watch that character's life unfold. We can watch that character's joys, that character's suffering. We can watch that character's accomplishments, that character's failures. But since I'm the witness of a movie, how can I say I did it? Even if I had gone to the trouble to sit down and plan a sermon. Which is what most ministers in the world do. Most ministers in the world, have at least one day a week, a few hours where they sit down and they plan out that Sunday sermon. All of the ideas that would come during that planning time just come. For me to claim that it was me, even if it happened in what appeared to be a planning time, is just as insane. Because I didn't make those ideas show up in my mind that I'm writing down on the paper during the quote planning time. The ideas just appear. So again, Ramana is saying you don't have to see yourself as the doer in order for the character to fulfill its role in the movie. So again, the question was, it is an established rule that so long as there is the least idea of I am the doer, self-knowledge cannot be attained. But is it possible for an aspirant who is a householder to discharge his duties properly without this sense? And Ramana answers, as there is no rule that action should depend upon a sense of being the doer. It is unnecessary to doubt whether any action will take place without a doer or an act of doing. Although the officer of a government treasury may appear in the eyes of others to be doing his duty attentively and responsibly all day long, he will be discharging his duties without attachment, thinking, "I have no real connection with all this money," and without a sense of involvement in his mind. In the same manner, a wise householder may also discharge without attachment the various household duties which fall to his lot according to his past karma, like a tool in the hands of another. Action and knowledge are not obstacles to each other. All right, so moving on to question number 24. Of use to his family is a wise householder who is unmindful of his bodily comforts. And of what use is his family to him? And my guess is, hear the word guess. Well, I think I won't even say that. I'm just going to stop and read the question again. Of what use to his family is a wise householder who is unmindful of his bodily comforts? And of what use is his family to him? Here's Ramana's answer. Although he is entirely unmindful of his bodily comforts, if, owing to his past karma, his family has to subsist by his efforts, he may be regarded as doing service to others. If it is asked whether the wise man derives any benefit from the discharge of domestic duties, it may be answered that, as he has already attained the state of complete satisfaction, which is the sum total of all benefits and the highest good of all, he does not stand to gain anything more by discharging family duties. So I think that, although I wouldn't have asked the question that the questioner asked, I guess what I wanted to say before was I get this sense that the questioner is at a stage that I was at an earlier time, the stage of wanting to get the heck away from responsibility. And I don't know that for a fact, but you guys know that I went through that not too long ago, you know, last summerish. You know, I wanted to, in fact, we were just looking at the house that I wanted to buy. I wanted to leave my family, leave Awakening Together, buy this really cheap house in La Vida, and escape. And, you know, if you're in that phase, then, you know, you might be sitting in front of a guru asking kind of a leading question. So the guru will say, "Oh, you're no use to your family. Your family's no use to you. Go ahead, go," you know, because that's what you want to hear. And so I kind of got the sense that the questioner was in that stage. Only because I've been in that stage. Yeah, house has been there, done that. You know, there's just this point where you kind of want to escape everything and everyone. But what Ramana seems to point out here, in fact, let me just read the answer again. Ramana says, although he is entirely unmindful of his bodily comforts, if, owing to his past karma, his family has to subsist by his efforts, he may be regarded as doing service to others. That is how I feel in my relationship with my family, especially in my relationship with Ron, because Jasmine is primarily gone now. But Ron is here. And on weekends, we do, quote, fun things. Like this weekend, we're going to see the Cirque du Soleil on ice. And when I go to see the Cirque du Soleil on ice with Ron, I feel like I'm serving Ron. That's genuinely how I feel. I feel like I'm always in service. Now, obviously, the service that I do to Awakening Together is pretty clear. And the appearance may be that I do service to Awakening Together all week, and then on weekends I take off from service and I go have fun. But actually, in my heart, that still feels like service. I feel like I am serving Ron. And if you really listen to that with a sexist tone, that might not sound so good, but it doesn't feel like that to me. it's just like, it's just, it's, it's a lack of self-centeredness. It's a lack of self-centeredness. You're serving whoever is there, and who's there for me right now is Ron. So I serve Ron. I was telling Lisa that the next thing we're going to do is we're going to get this really big TV with this really loud sound bar, which really kind of will turn our living room into almost like a movie theater, which I don't care about at all. At all. But I go with Ron, I look at the TVs, I look at the sound bars. When he turns to me and says, "What do you think? Does that one have a clear picture?" I look at it and I go, "That has a really clear picture." And I play along, but I'm serving Ron. Ron wants a really big TV. And so, and so I'm happy to have a big TV brought into the house. You guys still there? I'm hearing strange noises. I bet my recording just stopped. Yes, it did. Did you record today, Cheryl? Because I think the Windows side of my computer just rebooted, which means my recording is no good. Dame, as they say in Japanese. So if you recorded, Cheryl, we're good. Okay, excellent. I'm going to need your recording today. So what Rama is explaining to this man is that this angst that he is feeling, that wants to leave his family, like I no longer benefit from the family, from the family relationship, and I don't think they're benefiting from me, and I just want to leave. What Ramana is really saying is that there's still a higher level stage that you will get to. And that higher level stage is action karma. That higher level stage is doing whatever comes to you to do without wanting it to be different. And it's all service. So no longer wanting to escape the family, no longer wanting to escape the job. But being in service to the family and being in service to employer, right? That's a higher state of seeing. Again, Ramana says, although he is entirely unmindful of his bodily comforts, if, owing to his past karma, his family has to subsist by his efforts, he may be regarded as doing service to others. If it is asked whether the wise man derives any benefit from the discharge of domestic duties, it may be answered that, as he has already attained the state of complete satisfaction. I'm going to stop there for a moment. I feel that way too. I feel like I'm not self-realized, I'm not awake, but I feel like I have attained the state of complete satisfaction, where I'm happy. No matter what I am doing, right? So I don't need things to be a certain way. It's so funny. Hold on, let me get a drink of water and I'll tell you guys a funny little story. At least to me, it's funny. Recently, we got some new furniture. And the catalyst for getting the furniture was Ron bought me a lovely, lovely, lovely picture of La Vida. Of the mountains, the Spanish Peak and Gimmer's Butte and the Big Wall. And the way our living room was set up, where the picture hung, I couldn't actually look at it because it was to my side so much that I would have to kind of twist my body in my chair to look at the picture. And I've always felt the way our living room was set up, it always felt boxy to me. I've lived that way happily, but still, when I sat down, I kind of felt like I was in a box, like there wasn't a feeling of a flow in the room. And now, when Ron bought this picture that I couldn't look at, it was like, this just isn't making sense anymore. And I was like, let's get some new furniture. And what I did is I went and I bought a sectional, which has, I can now sit on one side of the sectional if I'm looking at the picture and meditating, and I can sit on another side of the sectional if I need to be facing the TV, right? And it has an open flow to it, and it feels really good. Well, Ron, when I went to buy myself a new sectional, Ron decided he also wanted a new love seat. So he bought a love seat, and the sectional and the love seat, even though we bought them separately, they look pretty good together. And Saturday, all of the furniture, the last part of the furniture was delivered, and the house looks so nice. I mean, I really loved it. I thought, I'm glad we did this. It feels so good. I took pictures, I posted it on Facebook, and 24 hours it continued to change because this is when he decided he wanted the big TV. The big sound bar. He's ordered another piece of furniture. And what I think is about to happen is the living room is going to become pretty crowded in a second. Already a table that I had in there has been moved out to make room. And so it's changing and I'm totally happy with it. But what's really, really funny to me is I'm happy that in 9.5 years of living in this house, I got to have 24 hours of thinking it was perfect. I mean, really, they're like, this is the way this living room was meant to be. Okay, now we're going beyond that point, but that's okay. But I'm literally happy, happy, happy that I got to experience 24 hours of, wow, this is really perfect for this room, And I'm happy that I happened to take pictures that day, And I'm happy that we're going past that point now and we're going to add more furniture and a big, loud TV. That, yes, Cheryl, that is the loving all method. I was happy before in my little box. I was happy on Saturday when it felt perfect. And I will be happy this coming Saturday when we're adding more furniture and it is changing again. Right?
It all started from a 12-inch picture.
It all started from a picture, but you should see the picture.
Oh, thank
You've
you.
seen the picture, yeah. The picture's gorgeous. And it wasn't just that. I mean, like I said, I've always felt kind of boxy, even though I was happy and not thinking it needs to change, accepting as it was. It's always felt boxy. And whenever I wanted to turn and talk to Ron, I had to twist. The sectional is much better.
The feng shui.
Is it on the site, the picture? You can kind of see the picture. If you go look at the furniture shots that I posted on Saturday on Facebook, the picture of Ron's new love seat hanging above it is this picture. And you can kind of see it. Maybe if you make it bigger, with your fingers, you can see the picture a little
Hang this
better.
up, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, the point is when you've reached a point of satisfaction, you can't honestly be saying to gain anything, even if you're getting all new furniture and a big TV. Because the truth is, the happiness is the same all the time. There's not an actual gain there, there's more of a continuance. It's a continuance of happiness. And yes, things in the world changes, right? Things in the world change all of the time. But you can't actually be said to gain anything because the happiness was already perfected. That's the point. So, Ramana says, if it is asked whether the wise man derives any benefit from the discharge of domestic duties, it may be answered that as he has already attained the state of complete satisfaction, which is the sum total of all benefits and the highest good of all, he does not stand to gain anything more by discharging family duties. In other words, it doesn't even matter if he continues to get promoted in his job and ends up really making a huge salary by comparison to the other people in the country, and he's really a very wealthy man at some point. He can't be said to gain anything because even when he was a pauper and struggling, he already had that complete satisfaction. When he worked in the mailroom, he had that complete satisfaction. The fact that he made it to CEO and now runs the company Hasn't changed a thing. Just like going from my boxy living room to my perfect 24 hours to whatever it's going to be this coming weekend after more stuff comes. There's no change in the self. The complete satisfaction is constant. And again, when you've reached this state of complete satisfaction, you're not going to be sitting in front of Ramana Maharshi or anybody else trying to get him to tell you, yeah, go ahead, leave your family. When you're sitting there in front of Ramana Maharshi and you're kind of hinting, like, I don't really need to stay with my family anymore, do I? It's because you haven't reached complete satisfaction. There's an angst in you, and you're thinking, if I can just change this, if I could just get out of this sense of responsibility, then I could be free. Right? Complete satisfaction doesn't ask those questions. So, going on to question number 25. How can cessation of activity and peace of mind be? Boy, this is, I don't know if this is all one person or a bunch of complaining married people. Here we go with another householder question. Are you ready? How can cessation of activity and peace of mind be attained in the midst of household duties, which are of the nature of constant activity? And I'll tell you, I know what constant activity is. If you go upstairs in my house right now, you're going to find on my stove a cookie sheet and a spatula that's been sitting there since Tuesday evening when Danielle came over for dinner. And it's not washed yet. And do you know why it's not washed yet? I haven't had 5 minutes to wash it. That's the honest truth. That's what we call constant activity. But does constant activity mean unhappiness? No, it doesn't have to be that way. But apparently, the questioner does not yet know that because it seems to be with this constant activity, right? How can I get to peace of mind? How can cessation of activity and peace of mind be attained in the midst of household duties, which are of the nature of constant activity? Actually, Danielle was here Monday night. So it's been sitting there a little longer than I thought. Yeah. So Danielle was here Monday night. So it's been sitting there since Monday night. And I haven't had 5 minutes to wash it. Okay, here we go. As the activities of the wise man exist only in the eyes of others and not in his own, although he may be accomplishing immense tasks, he really does nothing. Therefore, his activities do not stand in the way of inaction and peace of mind, for he knows the truth that all activities take place in his mere presence and that he does nothing. Hence, he will remain as the silent witness of all the activities taking place. Now, I can't claim, I don't think, to say that all activity happens in my presence. That's like being the sun. When you are the sun, and I mean the sun in the sky, S-U-N, when you are the sun, you are just there, and all the things that happen on earth are happening in your presence. And when we fully awaken to the self, we are like the sun. Right? The self is just there, and all the things that are happening on earth are happening in its presence. But I am not self-realized, so I can't claim to have that genuine experience. But I do to some degree, maybe like I'm 70% there. I do to some degree have the sense. Let me see how I can word this and be as honest as possible. It is a sense of I'm not doing anything. I mean, even though this body moves and goes from here to here to here, and you can hear how busy it is if I haven't had a chance to wash a cookie sheet. How long it would take to wash a cookie sheet? 5 minutes. If I haven't had 5 minutes since around, since Monday evening. You can see that there's a lot of business here, but what it really feels like to me, here's what it feels like. It feels like I am on a moving sidewalk. And the moving sidewalk just keeps moving, and I'm going with it. Right? So I go from thing to thing to thing to thing because that's where the moving sidewalk is carrying me. And when the moving sidewalk eventually carries me to wash the cookie sheet, I will wash the cookie sheet. The moving sidewalk hasn't gone there yet. That's what it feels like. Does that make sense? So again, it's a strong sense of, I mean, even though again, this body is doing, whatever it's been doing since Monday night when I ate that shrimp and little broccoli cheese bites that I cooked on the cookie sheet. This body is doing everything that it's doing, but there's a sense of stillness that is always here, even when the body is moving from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. The sense of stillness is louder than the things that are being done. The sense of stillness stands. I don't know what word you use for it. Bigger, grander. It's more obvious. That's the best word. It's more obvious than the moving about. So again, the question is, how can you have all this crap you got to do? I mean, that's kind of the attitude, I think. How can you have all this crap you got to do and get peace of mind? Again, don't I have to get out of my job, get out of my family, get out? And the answer is no. No. The doing at some point does begin to just be there. And it's happening. And once upon a time, I can tell you, once upon a time, that cookie sheet. Well, heck, I got a guest in the house. That's just downright embarrassing to have a before when I, Lisa, I can't even quite remember how you got here now. It hasn't even been that long. It came
Yesterday,
up very, very quickly,
I saw a
right?
cookie sheet
Yeah,
walking across the room.
yeah. Like this wasn't planned for Lisa to come. It kind of happened very quickly. And so now Lisa's here. She was here for one night. Now she's here for two nights. It all is literally all just happening, all unplanned. But once upon a time, if there was a sudden plan that a guest was coming, even if it wasn't in the flow, even if the moving sidewalk wasn't going by washing the cookie sheet, I would have had to jump off that sidewalk, run over there, and somehow wash that cookie sheet anyway because a guest was coming. And if a guest walked in my house and found that cookie sheet sitting on my stove with a few crumbs on it, because that's really all it's got on it.
Two, I count two.
Yeah, too, she says, because I ate everything that was on the cookie sheet. But that would have meant I was unworthy. That's what it would have meant once upon a time. I'm the scum of the earth because I have a dirty cookie sheet sitting on the stove. And see, when that stuff is gone, you can have a, you don't try to make certain things get done. You just go with where the moving sidewalk is taking you, and you do what the moving sidewalk brings you up to do this thing. And then the moving sidewalk takes you to do another thing. And then the moving sidewalk takes you to do another thing. And you just go where the moving sidewalk goes. And what isn't done, someday the moving sidewalk's going to go there, and that's when you'll do it. Right? And it doesn't have anything to do with you, with your worth, with your value. And if it doesn't have anything to do with you, then it doesn't touch your peace of mind. You see, it touches your peace of mind when you think it has to do with you. When you think the fact that the cookie sheet isn't washed means I'm unworthy. When you make that connection, then that cookie sheet can steal your peace of mind in a nanosecond. Right? But if it has nothing to do with you, the moving sidewalk just hasn't gone there, and you're just taking the ride, how can it steal your peace of mind? I used to hate pulling weeds. I mean, I think pulling weeds was the thing I hated the most out of all, jobs that we have to do in our lifetime. And somewhere along the way, just practicing this healing that we all practice, this letting go of false beliefs, I remember somewhere along the line, one day I was out there pulling weeds and being happy as could be, and then I noticed, oh my God, look at me. Look at me, I'm pulling weeds and I'm happy. I mean, that was a miracle, you know, because I always hated pulling weeds. I dreaded pulling weeds. I grumbled in my mind, you know, but that's unnecessary. That's just unnecessary mental stuff. If you just ride the moving sidewalk and go where the moving sidewalk takes you, you know, everything gets done in its own time, and you are just happy. Just going along for the ride. So again, the question was, how can cessation of activity and peace of mind be attained in the midst of household duties, which are of the nature of constant activity? And Ramana Maharshi says, as the activities of the wise man exist only in the eyes of others and not in his own, because he's on the moving sidewalk, as the activities of the wise man exist only in the eyes of others and not in his own, although he may be accomplishing immense tasks, he really does nothing. Therefore, his activities do not stand in the way of inaction, right? Isn't it inaction to be on a moving sidewalk? Right? Therefore, his activities do not stand in the way of inaction and peace of mind. For he knows the truth that all activities take place in his mere presence. Like I said, I can't quite go that far in my experience. It's more like I'm moved into these things rather than it's in my mere presence. So my shift has not shifted back that far yet. But for he knows the truth that all activities take place in his mere presence and that he does nothing. Hence, he will remain as the silent witness of all the activities taking place. Question number 26. Just as the sage's past karma is the cause of his present activities, will not the impressions caused by his present activities adhere to him in the future? Answer. Only one who is free from all latent tendencies is a sage. That being so, how can the tendencies of karma affect him who is entirely unattached to activity? So, the freer we are from our current life, the less karma we are taking on is really what that means, no matter what you are moving through. Now, I will tell you that, I don't know how to tell you this, that I don't believe in karma in the way that that the Indians teach it. To the Indians, we are individual souls, and an individual soul reincarnates as many different personalities over, you know, many different centuries or thousands of years, and carries with it, the individual soul carries with it a karma that it is stuck with until somehow it transcends that particular karma. I don't see us as individual souls. I see us as one consciousness that creates many different temporary individuals. And as one consciousness that creates many different temporary individuals, there is no such thing as an individual soul. The only thing that is true about us is the one consciousness. However, consciousness can have imprints on it. So, let's say I don't want a big, loud TV. I just don't, because I'm not going to look spiritual if I have a big loud TV. If you guys walk in my house and there's this big loud TV, immediately you're going to say, oh, Regina's not who she pretends to be, because look how big her TV is, right? Isn't that what you're going to say? So I don't want this big TV, because you're going to think stuff of me, and I got an image to uphold. I'm way too cool for a big loud TV, because I'm this cool spiritual teacher person. All right, if that's my attitude, and I hold on to that attitude. Yeah, she's watching TV all the time. If that's the only place my moving sidewalk goes to, is the TV. If that's the attitude that I have, and somehow we get this big TV, and you know, I don't know how long the big TV is going to last, right? 10, 15 years, maybe just get bigger and bigger. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? We have big TVs till the day I die, and I'm holding a grudge the whole time. Right? I'm not free of the big TV. I have a grievance against the big TV. That creates an imprint on consciousness. And that imprint will affect manifestation undoubtedly. But when Regina dies, Regina's dead. I'm not dead. Consciousness is not dead. But Regina's dead. There's no individual soul who's going to be born in another lifetime and has to work at some big screen factory until she gets over her big screen hatred. We are not individuals. I don't know how else to say that. We are one. It's more like someone said to me once, so you mean there's a collective karma? And, you know, that's one way you could look at it, except the word collective is not true because we are one. But there is a karma, and the karma does create the script of the world. The world unfolds, and the way the world unfolds because of what we get stuck with in our minds. That is true. Right? That is true. The sage is one who has transcended the world as real and now sees himself or herself as the pure consciousness. It's almost like the imprint is on the skin of consciousness. Not that consciousness has skin, but let's pretend like it does for a moment. The imprint is on the skin of consciousness, and the sage awakens to the heart of consciousness. What does an imprint on the skin have to do with the heart? It has no effect whatsoever. It doesn't matter if the skin is covered with imprints. It has nothing to do with the heart. And so since the sage awakens to the heart of consciousness, the sage is not affected by the imprints that are continuing through the believing that's happening at the level of the world. The sage is like the sun, and everything is happening in its mere presence, but it has nothing to do with any of it. It's completely free, liberated, enlightened. So again, the question was, just as the sage's past karma is the cause of his present activities, will not the impressions, now first of all, there's an error in the question, which, you know, Ramana kind of addresses. The error is that the sage is this body sitting in front of me. Like, you know, Ramana is the sage, and I, the questioner, am not a sage. Right? But the body is a temporary manifestation. The sage is the light beyond all manifestation. That's what the sage awakens to. It is the light beyond all manifestation. So even to point at a body and say, the sage, there's an error in that thinking right there. It's a common error, but there's an error in that thinking right there. You're looking at an appearance and calling it the sage when the sage has awakened beyond appearance entirely. However, I'm running out of time, so let me finish this. Just as the sage's past karma is the cause of his present activities, will not the impressions caused by his present activities adhere to him in the future, like there's an individual soul there? Ramana answers, only one who is free from all the latent tendencies is a sage. Only one who has become free of all impressions on consciousness, because that one is awakened to the heart of consciousness, is a sage. That being so, how can the tendencies of karma affect him who is entirely unattached to activity? How can whatever impressions are on the skin affect the heart? I mean, if you guys like take your fingernails and squeeze some skin on your hands so that you create little impressions there, you can see the little impressions your fingernails made on your skin. But is the heart affected? So the impressions are temporary on the skin, and they will affect the appearance of the world for as long as they continue to be on the skin or the surface of consciousness. But the sage awakens to the heart of consciousness and is in no way affected by those impressions. And the next, we have 2 minutes left. Let's go ahead and do one more question because it's really short. Number 27. Oh, okay. I don't think we even care about this question. Number 27, what is the meaning of brahmacharya, whatever the heck that is? You guys care about this question? Only inquiry into Brahman could be called brahmacharya. Okay, well, that was, yeah, who cares? The next question has to do with brahmacharya, too. So maybe I'll go ahead and mark number 27, and next week when we have more time, I'll look up brahmacharya, and we'll see if there's something in the question we care about. But it definitely sounds like a Hindu question to me. One thing I do want to say is that my schedule on Wednesday is changing. So if you really like the Guiding Light and want to be here for the Guiding Light, be aware that next week I will be starting, and from then on, I will be starting 1/2 hour earlier. So I have been starting for quite some time now at 2:30 Eastern time. I'm moving to 2 Eastern time. It'll be an hour from 2 to 3. Anne will be right before me. Right now she's right after me. She'll be right before me next week. She'll be at 1:30 Eastern time. Then I'll come on at 2 Eastern time. And then Jacqueline will come on at 3 Eastern time. So Anne and Jacqueline are flip-flopping. I'm remaining sandwiched in the middle, but a little earlier. All right? So again, I'll be here at 2 Eastern time next week, which is 11 Pacific time. And, you don't need to post today's teaching. I posted on Regina Dawn Acres' website, Cheryl. If you would just save it. Let me text you and tell you where to upload it to, and then I can post it. I'll text you, okay? Bye.